Hello, I'm Chris Basden, an editor with AICPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the JFA Podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. Today on the podcast, I'm going to be talking about some important elements of tax reform with my guest, Annette Nellen. Practitioners still have a lot of questions about tax reform, including everything from dealing with binding and non-binding Tax Cuts and Jobs Act guidance to individual planning considerations. Today, Annette Nellen is joining me on the podcast to address those issues. Annette is a CPA and CGMA who is a professor and director of the MST program at San Jose State University. She's also the chair of the AICPA's Tax Executive Committee. Good morning, Annette. How are you today?
Just fine, thank you.
Great. So what's the last year been like for tax practitioners? When was the last time they had to learn about so many changes, do you think?
Well, that's a good question, because I think a lot of practitioners perhaps weren't practicing back with the Tax Reform Act of 86. That was some time ago. My students remind me they weren't even born then, so it was a while back. Certainly the Tax Reform Act of 86 were significant changes. In fact, Congress highlighted it was so significant they renamed the Code of 1954 to be the Code of 1986. This one did not get redated, but certainly there are significant changes. There were over 100 changes in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And in probably in the last several years, over time, we've seen changes such as, remember, late 90s, significant changes in capital gains taxation, and including sale of a residence. In 2015, they brought about the partnership audit regime change, which is pretty significant, though I think more hitting now than what people had to deal with in 2015. But so far as number of changes, no, we haven't seen this since the 86 Act, and many practitioners weren't practicing then.
Right. And that brings up another interesting question. What's the mood of practitioners right now as they prepare for busy season? I feel like practitioners, you know, when busy season arrives, they're always a little stressed anyway, no matter what. And in a year like this, do you think they're more stressed than usual or maybe not?
I would guess more towards more stressed. With the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act being signed December 22nd, 2017, and then starting to be effective on January 1st, well, most of it starting January 1st, 2018, that's when the practitioners are starting to prepare 2017 returns, and they've right. got to focus all their effort on that. And they're hearing, obviously, well, gee, there's significant changes, and when will I have the time to get in and really delve into those? And many clients do go on extension, and, of course, the corporate returns for calendar year companies going to October 15th. So I would guess now many practitioners are thinking, I'm going to delve into this. But also we've been seeing since roughly August more significant guidance coming out from the IRS. So this is an opportunity to get into the statute and that proposed guidance. And, of course, waiting for the final guidance to make sure, okay, is that really the final word as we get going?
And you were talking about guidance. That's obviously extremely important to practitioners. What types of guidance has the IRS issued to help us comply with and plan under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changes?
Well, all types of guidance, and I like to use the word guidance in two contexts. Binding guidance, meaning something that counts as authority. If you look at the regs under 1.6662-4 defining authority, such as in substantial authority. Also, that binding guidance means something that was published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin. That would be regulations, notices, revenue rulings, written procedures. So you definitely want to pay very careful attention to that binding guidance. There's the other kind of guidance, which I always like to put in quotation marks, air quotes here, a guidance so far as something we'll see maybe just showing up on IRS website, perhaps as an FAQ, instructions to forms. That's not binding guidance. For example, FAQs, when they're just published on the IRS website, those aren't binding. They can change. They can tweak a word. They can remove them. I always like to remind folks, if you do ever rely on an FAQ, and a lot of times FAQs are just restating what the code and the reg state, so it's, you know, fine. But if you are relying on one that you're like, I didn't see that answered anywhere else, print that off, copy it, because there's no guarantee you go back the next day or the next month, the next year, that FAQ is going to be there in that particular form. But be aware, you know, it is not binding guidance so far as do I have substantial authority for that position. So we want to be watching all of it. The $10,000 SALT or state and local tax cap, what does that $10,000 consist of? Is that some pro rata share of all of your state and local taxes? Or are you pick and choose? It does have tax consequences, but I don't know if they're going to issue any binding guidance, or will we just see that explained in the publication about state and local taxes?
What do practitioners do if guidance doesn't exist by the time they file a return? I mean, after all, as you mentioned earlier, there were over 100 changes to this TCJA.
Well, the statute's the key thing. Sometimes it's not entirely clear. For example, the change on alimony treatment says, well, for agreements executed before 2019, you'll follow the rules we've been used to, where you deduct alimony paid, pick up alimony received. What exactly does executed mean? So sometimes the code itself just isn't clear enough. Then you should go to the committee reports that the House, the Senate, and the Conference Committee put together when they were drafting the Public Law 115-97, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We also should see a blue book that might add a little bit more clarification about what they were intending on some of those provisions.
There are several changes to itemized deductions for individuals. Do you have any planning advice for reducing the adverse impact of these changes?
On the taxes, we are waiting for some additional guidance from the IRS. For example, what does that $10,000 cap consist of? Do I pick and choose what taxes fall in there, or do I have to do some pro rata? The answer is relevant. For example, if you've got a sole proprietor claiming home office deduction, they need to know, well, what did I already deduct on Schedule A so far as my property taxes on the home? Also relevant in calculating the net investment income tax. Also relevant, should you get a refund of your state income tax? Did you get a tax benefit of that in the year? So we do need to know what that consists of, and so watch for guidance on that. Then obviously a big deal with some states focused on these SALT workarounds, as well as many states already had state tax credit donation programs in place, where if, for example, in California, there's one for that's been around a few years, put money into the College Access Fund, and you get a 50% state tax credit. That's been around for a few years. Some states have ones with even up to 100% credit. Well, the IRS and Treasury said after Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we're concerned about these, especially if any states are going to create new donation funds and new credits to get around the $10,000 cap. The way they'd be getting around it is changing what would be a state tax deduction to instead be a federal charitable contribution. And the IRS did come out with proposed regulations, as they promised back, I think, in May, that basically would say if the individual has put money into the state fund and receives a state credit that's more than 15%, then they have to reduce their charitable contribution on the federal return by the amount of that credit they got, and that would apply for donations to those funds after August 27th. And we're waiting for final regs. There were close to 8,000 comments that came in on that set of proposed regs. Many of them were saying the same thing. It was interesting. There was a group that seemed to be, IRS, we're so glad you issued those because we think this has been a maybe abusive area. Then others saying, well, gee, wait, this program's been around for years. You've never questioned it. Why all of a sudden would this not be valid? There were even the attorney generals in four states, including New York, New Jersey, and California, submitted comments. Which, you know, getting into some of the technical legal arguments. So watching what does happen with those credits and what we'll see as a final word. After the proposed regs came out, the IRS issued a news release, again, not binding guidance, but it was just reminding us that, well, if a business, whether sole proprietor, corporation, partnerships, S-Corp, if they were to donate to that fund and get a credit, but they're really getting a business benefit from it, maybe it gives them some advertising or something, was a reminder that when a business gives money to a charity, it might not be a charitable contribution. It might be a business deduction. So I'm getting advertising from that, for example. So that actually is something to think about for any of your business clients for a few reasons. If you've got clients that will no longer be itemizing, because, let's say, they don't have a mortgage deduction. All they maybe have is roughly $10,000 of state tax. They're married. They're getting a $24,000 standard deduction. If that individual has a sole proprietorship or is involved with a partnership or S-Corp, they might want to think about, well, I still want to give to charity, but maybe I'll give it with a business reason. They want to look very carefully at what causes it to be a business deduction as opposed to a charitable contribution and document it. They actually got benefits back, like advertising, that would take it out of the charitable realm. So they want to take a look at that. On the mortgage interest, I caution people to be very careful to address where their client has home equity debt. I find it gets to be a bit confusing because if the client borrowed money against their home but made improvements, that's actually acquisition debt. The bank will call it equity debt, but it doesn't really matter what the bank calls it. It's what the law calls it, where we're looking at what did you do with the funds, and if it's secured by the home, used to improve the home, and you're within the acquisition debt cap, it's acquisition debt. If it wasn't used for home improvement, then your home equity debt is no longer qualified residence interest. So instead, we would apply the tracing rules under the regs under 163-8T. And do note, those have been modified by a notice 89-35, which has a taxpayer favorable rule in it. It's a 30-day any account rule, which can get you perhaps a better result for your what otherwise would probably be personal non-deductible. And then I think on charitable contributions, if you do have folks that are close to that standard deduction line, maybe they want to be bunching their charitable contributions every 2 or 3 years. So they sometimes take standard deduction, maybe the second or third year because they've made a lot of charitable contributions. They're taking itemized deductions. If you've got a client with significant IRA funds, if they're age 70 and a half or older, look into the qualified distribution, following all the rules and substantiation on that as well. And finally, on miscellaneous itemized deductions that were subject to 2% of AGI floor, which is no longer deductible, at least for 2018 through 2025. If it's unreimbursed employee business expense, encourage that client to talk to their employer about setting up an accountable plan and reimbursing them for that. If you've got for your tax prep fees, do pay attention to Rev Ruling 9229 that would let you allocate some of those prep fees to the Schedule C, to the Schedule E, for example. So that may help in looking at your itemized deductions and perhaps maximizing deductions from all the changes as well.
So we hear a lot about the 199A 20% deduction for qualified business income. What other significant tax preferences were added by the TCJA for individuals?
Well, perhaps not a lot. Perhaps there was more takeaway as opposed to adding, but many individuals will qualify for 199 Cap A for their business activity, including perhaps maybe their rental activity may raise to that level. Something that was in the legislation I don't think got a lot of attention until proposed regs came out in October are the qualified opportunity zone. If you've got clients that are generating capital gain income, if they want to look for any kind of deferral as well as perhaps a little bit of exclusion if they hold on to it, but they invest in a qualified opportunity fund, and I think we'll probably hear more of these funds being set up by whether brokerage firms, it's kind of still a question who is going to help set these things up, but they will certainly let people know they've set them up and they would love to take their money so they can get them into this deferral provision. That's under Code Section 1400Z-1 and -2, which I think just sounds funny. Maybe we didn't look at it because there have actually been other type of opportunity zones in the past that were fairly limited as to how they apply. But this one's actually fairly broad for really any kind of capital gain income that if you invest it within 180 days that you will get to defer it, plus holding it long enough, you'll get a little bit of exclusion as well. So taking a look at that. For clients that do make a lot of charitable contribution deductions, realizing that what had been just a 50% AGI threshold is now 60% for the cash contributions. Also, some employees might find that their employers might set up what's called qualified equity grants. There are a lot of restrictions on how that gets set up, but that might be something that might help as well. Then I think just, you know, overall planning, such as mentioned regarding what we do with any kind of itemized deduction cutback. Is there some alternative way that we can perhaps improve our planning over 1 year or maybe a span of years?
How can practitioners help clients understand the purpose of the TCJA and its effects on them and others?
Good question, because I think for individuals, they might be thinking, what was the point of all that? They're aware, you know, like this $10,000 SALT cap is something a big deal for many clients of CPAs because they're paying more than that and just kind of surprised, where'd that come from? Why are we doing that? But I think helping them to realize that the main point of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which has been talked about for some time, was a big focus on our corporate tax structure and making it more competitive on a global perspective. Our top rate of 35% was way out of line with what other industrialized countries do, which of course causes competitive pressure. We were hearing things like some companies merging with a non-U.S. corporation, an inversion, and becoming now a non-U.S. corporation. Well, if that's being done because of tax consequences, then you know, the tax code needs to be updated and modernized. So lowering that corporate rate and moving away from our worldwide system, which many countries don't use, was really a big gist of that. And then with lowering the corporate rate, businesses and CPAs reminded Congress, you know, not all businesses operate as a C corporation. Some operate as a partnership, S corp, or sole proprietorship. Should you lower their rate as well? And that's what the 199 cap A deduction was mostly intended to do. Then there certainly was talk about simplification, and you know, many taxpayers. I think the client base of many CPAs doesn't necessarily represent the whole population. Because when I mentioned this to CPAs that prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, 70% of individuals claimed a standard deduction. They said, oh, no, that can't be, because in your client base, that might not be the case, but among all the individuals, 70% claim a standard deduction. After the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, with the increase in standard deduction and as well as a cutback in some itemized deductions, that'll go up to 87% of individuals will be taking the standard deduction. So for many of those individuals, it's going to remain fairly simple. They're going to see that they're going to get pay less tax than they had in 2017 because of the increase in standard deduction, lowering of the rates. And if they have children under the age of 17, going from $1,000 child credit to a $2,000 child credit. And certainly many of the clients of CPAs are going to see they're paying less tax. The Tax Policy Center estimates that probably only about 6% of individuals will end up paying more. But it's really just meant to try to make some long-standing reforms, because certainly the world has changed in the last 10 years where more global business activity and we were out of line, especially with the corporate tax, with how the rest of the world taxes. That was really the key point from it, then what other reforms. But we still have additional reforms that are going to be needed. For example, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did not make any effort to reduce our $400 billion tax gap. And I think things like those are still probably in the works as maybe the next phase of tax reform. It probably will not take 30 years to get to that point, I don't think.
And Annette, I'm sure that practitioners still have a lot of questions. Where can they go to get more resources about tax reform?
Well, the AICPA has a tremendous Tax Reform Resource Center. In fact, you just either Google it or go AICPA.org/tax reform. What you'll find there are links into the comment letters, and the staff and volunteers have been extremely busy in submitting very thoughtful comments to address some of the lack of clarity or where maybe a proposed rule we don't think works as effectively as it could. We will suggest alternatives to that. Also, there's a lot of resources so far as podcasts, webinars. There's also a whole host of tools. There's a really nice two-page updated 199 Cap A flowchart, which really has a lot in it for just two pages. It'll give you a nice, really nice overview to that. But some client letters, really a lot right there. And the IRS also has a tax reform page, which is you should bookmark both of those. The tax reform one from the IRS is a place where anything they're issuing, the binding guidance and the non-binding guidance, is all listed there, which I think is helpful as well. So certainly bookmark the IRS tax reform webpage and then the AICPA tax reform one. It would be very helpful.
Thanks, Annette. And I'd also like to thank our audience for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, check out more JFA podcasts on our website and on Podomatic.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.